This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. For the fourth time this month, there was another tense meeting in Cambridge yesterday over the fatal police shooting of 20-year-old Saeed Faisal. Police have said Faisal appeared to be experiencing a mental health crisis and jumped from an apartment window with a knife and was cutting himself. They say they chased him for about five blocks, but he wouldn't drop the knife. After a less-than-lethal weapon still did not disarm Faisal, police shot and killed him. Cambridge officials say the incident is under investigation, but residents have been protesting and demanding more information, including the names of the officers involved and why the officer who shot has been placed on administrative leave. In an attempt to reduce tensions, at yesterday's special city council meeting, the councilors met virtually to discuss the shooting and police policies. Cambridge Mayor Sumbul Siddiqui said she's wrestling with questions about how to make improvements.
We have these policies, procedures, protocols. A 20-year-old man is dead, young man is dead. And thinking through what these policies are, they're being used. And where does the accountability lie?
We want to talk about that question and others surrounding police use of force in Massachusetts. How should authorities respond when a person is in crisis? How should police balance the safety of the person in the emergency with the safety of a community? Are police equipped to handle these emergencies? And are they being asked to respond to larger societal problems? Donna Mosh is president of the Massachusetts Association for Mental Health, and she's with us to talk about this. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Deborah.
Also with us in studio, Newton Police Chief John Carmichael. Chief Carmichael, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we want to let you know, listeners, that we will be talking about violence and mental health issues, and some of you might find that upsetting. So that warning before we begin. So, Donna, let's start with you. The statistics that I've read are pretty grim. About a quarter of police shootings involve someone having a mental health crisis. Is that right?
Actually, in a 2016 Globe article, the citation was that half of all police shootings in Massachusetts that involved someone being killed or of people with a mental health condition. Mm. There are national statistics that indicate that people that have these conditions or who call police in crisis are 16 times more likely than the general public to be killed by police. Mm.
And you know, we've been talking about this for years, and of course it's come up very recently in Cambridge in these several community meetings and city council meetings about the shooting in Cambridge earlier this month. And Cambridge police say they have been well-trained to respond to crises. And I want to play a piece of tape here from one of those meetings. Cambridge Police Commissioner Christine Elo told city councilors that police were operating from the perspective that they had to protect the safety of the community when they responded to Faisal on January 4th. Let's listen to that tape.
So it was not an option for us to leave that scene or to not pursue him as he's running through Cambridgeport with this large knife.
Don, I wonder, in a situation involving someone in crisis who has a weapon and is experiencing a mental health emergency, what do you think should be done?
Well, there are a variety of steps that can be taken. And I don't want to say that Cambridge, along with 115 other cities and towns in the Commonwealth, out of a total of 351 cities and towns, now have grants from the Commonwealth for diversion, for crisis intervention training, and for hiring clinicians to work closely with police, known as co-responders. That said, a number of other departments have taken it upon themselves to make investments to train police in crisis intervention. In a very high-stress, high-stakes crisis like the one that occurred in Cambridge, involving what police would define as a lethal weapon. The CIT training is not deep on that. And some have suggested that there are other kinds of trainings that would be very complementary to crisis intervention training, such as integrating communications assessment and tactics training, known as ICAT or ICAT training, which is a training for first responders who may be put in a position of needing to use force. And there are other trainings that have been conducted to help people through not just the 10% to 20% as some of our police departments and 911 or PSAPs have reported, the number, those numbers of calls that involve a possible mental health crisis or a mental health issue. But for the those where there, again, is a crisis that involves someone, for whatever reason, trying to defend themselves or otherwise with a weapon. And I think it's difficult. It's a situation that responding in a situation like that relies heavily on what one's training is, what experience someone has had with a situation like that, and their judgment, their whatever innate knowledge and skills they have. So if you haven't been trained in de-escalation or the way, for instance, a team that gets sent out in the case of a hostage crisis or whatever has had extensive training. If you haven't had that kind of training and experience, fortunately, these are not incidents that are happening every day. And many officers may not have had this experience. It's difficult in the moment not to rely on other training you may have had. And with police trained that, you know, if someone has a sharp object and they're within 21 feet of that individual with that sharp object being presented in, you know, what's perceived to be a threatening way, police are trained to a different kind of response in that moment than de-escalation. And so it's, I think we have to think more about that, but also the public health and behavioral system needs to not only step up more what they can offer in partnership to the police and public safety programs, but be able themselves to participate in the kind of in-depth training that make people feel comfortable and also able to protect them if they incorporate them in a team like that. We have co-responders now that many of the police departments use, but officers sometimes out of concern for the safety of the co-responder will leave the co-responder outside of that kind of a crisis mm-hmm. situation. Mm-hmm. So we have to think through how we could make it possible to integrate all those capabilities in a response.
Okay, I want to bring Chief Carmichael in here. Let's talk about some of those things. First off, the bigger picture of balancing public safety needs when police respond to something like this, and if police are trained to deal with a threatening situation in one way, then how do you balance that with also trying to de-escalate a potentially volatile situation?
Yeah, so the quick question is yes, all Massachusetts police officers are trained in how to deal with mental health crisis and how to de-escalate situations. But so far, the conversation that we've had so far today has been about the outcome and some very tragic situations. There's many situations, hundreds and hundreds, that result in very positive outcomes. And what we're doing here is we're putting the outcome on the police officer on the street who is patrolling our neighborhoods and keeping the community safe. And we're putting this burden on them, where we should really be looking at the entire failure of the system, the mental health system in and of itself, the healthcare system, because that's where these situations are brought up. And there, many times what you will see is there are many opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to intervene through the mental health system. And many times that's not happening. We will section people. We take them to the hospital. They're
involuntarily.
Yeah, they're regulated mm-hmm. and they're sent back out. And basically what the police are doing, we're going to these calls over and over and over again for the same thing and with no real remedy for it. What's very important to note is that what we need to do is have this system where we are not working in silos. The police cannot deal with mental illness on our own. It has to be an independent response with DMH and organizations like Riverside, our hospitals, our mental health clinicians, and that's why we've created community crisis intervention teams. So these stakeholders are all at the table talking about these matters and talking about case studies and how we deal with these situations differently and better. You can't just talk about the police officer at the end of some tragic situation that happens and put the blame on the cop. I heard the word accountability. Accountability is all of us. That we all own that, mm-hmm. Not just the officer in the street. We're putting a tremendous burden on them. And what I often hear is that, you know, the officers are, they're not well-equipped, they're not well-trained. There's nothing further from the truth. Officers in Massachusetts, through the Municipal Police Training Committee, have been trained on crisis intervention training for years. Dynamics of addiction, Alzheimer's and dealing with dementia patients, dealing with people with disabilities, interactions with people with mental illness. We have crisis intervention training here in Massachusetts, 40-hour classes that are the Memphis model, which is very important, mental health first aid, all officers are trained in. We have many departments have joined the One Mind campaign through IACP, which also, in addition to those training, also has partnerships with members like the Community Crisis Intervention Team, and policies that are written to address these situations. I heard ICAT was mentioned. Many police officers in Massachusetts are trained in ICAT training, ABLE training, active bystander law enforcement. We are very well trained in dealing with mental health calls.
So the question is then, and I understand, I'm not saying that police are the only ones responsible for the failures in our mental health system, and we know that it is a very flawed system. But the police officers are the ones who use the guns in this case, and we want to talk about that. And you know, there was a recent lawsuit filed over a 2021 shooting in Cambridge. It had some similarities, in Newton rather. It had some similarities to the Cambridge shooting, where a man who was apparently in a mental health crisis had a knife, and police were called, and they used a less than lethal weapon, and then ended up shooting and killing 28-year-old Michael Conlin here. And yes, officers apparently were trained in the department, but what can help avoid these kinds of things, Chief?
Well, what can avoid them is to have a mental health system that's not letting people fall through the cracks in the first place. Years ago, we had institutions here all over Massachusetts that where people were treated and helped with mental illness. We changed that model. We moved the model into more community-based, living in a neighborhood, living by themselves, which is great. The problem is if we also still live in a free society. So if somebody's dysregulated or they're in some type of a mental health crisis, who's going to deal with that? It's not, it's not their primary mental health, doctor or whatever. It's the police. The police end up dealing with it. And that's why we have integrated a co-response model with a clinician to help us with those things. But when somebody picks up a knife, that narrative changes. That can ultimately turn into a deadly force situation, which we've seen many times happen here in Massachusetts and across the whole country. The fact that somebody has a mental health issue doesn't negate the fact that somebody has a knife and they could harm themselves, they could harm the public, they could harm the police officer. And so when that decision is made, to charge a police officer with a knife or another person, that the officer has an obligation to act on that, using the appropriate force necessary. And many times, what we do is we second-guess what the officer does. These are very dynamic situations, unfolding circumstances. These are situations where the officers are forced to make very split-second decisions in a time of stress. And we put that burden on them. And so when they act, we're supposed to support them, and have these conversations like we're having, and sometimes tough conversations, which are very important. But we don't look at it in retrospect and say, this is what the cop on the street did wrong over and over again. We look at, was it reasonable? Was it based on the totality of the circumstances? you know, and not in hindsight. These are the standards that we're supposed to abide by. Mm. And even when we do that, there's a lot of criticism that can come with that. We expect it. We expect scrutiny. You know, but what do we expect the police officer to do out there? There's role confusion here. What does the community, what does our community members expect us to do in these situations when someone has a knife and they become a threat to others?
I want to talk about alternative responses, right? Mm-hmm. There are alternative response teams. And there's been a lot of talk in Cambridge about this program known as HEART, the Holistic Emergency Alternative Response Team. And we spoke with one of the board members for HEART, Stephanie Grand. And she said since the shooting in Cambridge on January 4th of Mr. Faisal, calls to that group have tripled. The group began operating last fall, and it's a resident-led group to respond to mental health crises. But, you know, she said something interesting. She also told us that even if Cambridge HEART had been fully scaled up earlier this month at the time of the shooting, it would not have been able to respond to that call. And let's listen to why.
The city advocates for police responses to all crises that involve a weapon. There's no nuance in the distinctions between different types of weapons.
So her argument, Cambridge HEART's argument here, is that if it's a weapon that does not require ammunition, then perhaps trained mental health professionals should respond to calls like that. I want to get Donna to weigh in just a minute, but Chief, I'm wondering, what do you think of that? Should a resident-led group of folks?
That's unrealistic. You do not put a civilian person into a crisis situation with somebody that's armed, whether it's a firearm, a knife, a baseball bat, whatever it is. We don't do that. I would never put my clinician into a situation like that. Police officers, when somebody is contained, police officers, we have different LECs, law enforcement commands in Massachusetts, that respond and have trained crisis negotiators that can come out and help. And many, those are usually called very early on in these crisis situations. But you know, as far as a co-response model or help with things like that, law enforcement certainly welcomes that. We want as much help as we can get. Mm-hmm.
Donna Masha, what do you think of these alternative responses and how are they most effective?
I completely agree with the chief in as he talks about the many cases where clinicians are in partnership with police going out and being effective at managing a crisis situation. I would also say that our system has been for many, many years, decades, backing off of being on the front lines in urgent crisis situations in favor of police. And in the last few years, people have taken stock of that and realized that we have to make much greater commitment and investment to assuming an appropriate role and to be timely and well-trained to respond in a crisis and to be partners with police and public safety. And investments have been made, important investments now, in creating community behavioral health centers, where, by the way, it's a requirement of their operations that they have a partnership with their local police departments and public safety programs. Now, those went live in early January. Mm-hmm. And the chief mentioned working with Riverside, who is the designated agency there. There also are increasing, but need to be a lot more investments to support the work police are doing in training. We have to train clinicians to be strong and capable partners for police.
I'm sorry that we've got just about a minute and a half left here, so I want to ask both of you this question. If there was one thing, and you have to be really brief here, if there was one thing that you think would really make a difference in preventing tragedies like this, what would it be? Chief Carmichael.
It would be the full collaboration of all of the stakeholders involved. and we're doing that right now. It's a work in progress, but we're doing it. Working with DMH, working with organizations like Riverside, our local hospitals, police, clinicians, the whole mental health care system, and us working together. Again, we can't work in silos. It has to be. We can't be independent.
Okay.
It has to be a group effort.
Dan Amash, what would you say?
I agree with the chief that the integration is key, but resourcing services like urgent behavioral health care to get upstream of the deteriorated situations that cause these life-threatening and lethal crises is very critical. And again, urgent behavioral health care is now available in the Commonwealth since the 3rd of January in over 60 clinics.
And we'll see how that plays out.
We will. It's a critical, critical step.
All right. Dan Amash, president of the Massachusetts Association for Mental Health. John Carmichael is police chief in Newton. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, the internet gives us infinite knowledge right at our fingertips. We can look up information about how to dunk a basketball or find a chocolate chip cookie recipe. But people can also look up things that are more sinister. Google searches are included in the evidence that resulted in charges against a Cohasset man who's accused of murdering his wife. In this edition of Tech Talk, we're diving into the search of your internet searches. And we're asking, are there privacy protections? Should search engines like Google notify police about potentially dangerous user queries? The Boston Globe's technology writer, Hiawatha Bray, is here with us. Welcome back to Radio
Glad
Boston.
To be here.
So in this case in Cohasset, 39-year-old Anna Walsh, missing. Mm-hmm. And this has made international news. Her husband, Brian Walsh, was charged with her murder. And during his arraignment, a list of his Google searches was mentioned by Norfolk prosecutor Lynn B. Land. And we're going to play a clip of her talking about these searches. I want to note for listeners that this includes details about an alleged violent crime that some might find disturbing. But here's prosecutor B. Land describing Brian Walsh's alleged Google searches.
At 4:55 a.m. on January 1st, he searched how long before a body starts to smell. At 4:58 a.m., how to stop a body from decomposing. At 5:20 a.m., he searched how to embalm a body.
We should say that the tape there from that arraignment is from WCVB. Hiawatha, were you surprised that these queries outlined by the prosecutor here and allegedly done by on one of Walsh's children's iPads. Mm-hmm. Were you surprised that these were mentioned in court?
No, why not? I mean, this kind of evidence has become routine now in criminal cases. And this is an important thing. That's why we wanted to get into this story. We're trying to differentiate between what you can do in terms of an investigation after for example, a homicide has occurred versus the idea that Google might conceivably see this coming immediately and immediately notify police that people are searching for creepy stuff. Now, we know that at least in theory, there is some capability to do that because these companies do constantly monitor what people are doing. That's part of their whole business model. And so people have asked, well, why don't they throw up red flags when people go around searching for stuff like how to build a bomb, how to make a Molotov cocktail, how to hide a body, and so on? Well, they don't. I've tried to get Google to go directly on the record with me to talk about this. And, you know, they just laid off 12,000 people. And I'm thinking that's why they have not returned any of my calls. But I did contact one of the other major search engines, Bing. And they're very forthright about this. We just don't do that. We do not constantly monitor the things people are searching for, which is not the same as saying that they don't keep track of it. What I mean is they're not doing this in real time. Mm-hmm. But if you have, for example, an account with Microsoft or an account with Google, all of those searches are being saved.
For how long?
Well, now, again, Google didn't get back to me on this. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that as far as I know, the searches are saved indefinitely. Mm-hmm. But the details that are used for identifying who made the searches, for example, Bing will keep the IP address, which is the digital address of the computer that made the search, for 6 months. After that, they discard that. But they keep the searches because this is vital to their business model. They analyze what people are searching for as a way of figuring out what they're interested in so they can send them advertisements so they can make a lot of money. They don't want to throw that stuff away.
Right.
But that's very different from saying that in the long run, they will necessarily remember every search that you have done. Although you can, for example, on Google, you could save your own search history on your own account if you want to do that. You can go to Google and see your search history going back quite a long way. I should check how long it is. But the point is, yes, they can go back in time, find your searches, and if the police get a subpoena or a search warrant, they can get that information from Google or Bing or any of these other companies.
So it's only with a warrant? Or how often are police asking for records of your internet
search? Oh, it happens all the time. It's become a commonplace feature in criminal investigations because everybody does internet searches. But the problem is you cannot go from so-and-so searched for something really scary and dangerous to let's put that person under arrest. You can't even get a warrant. I talked to a couple of legal experts and they said based only on somebody's internet searches, you probably couldn't even get a warrant because people search for crazy things all the time.
But how does that even then hold up as evidence?
Well, that's the point. It has to be in it has to be in combination with other information. By itself, you're right. An internet search that you were looking for how to hide a dead body doesn't mean a blasted thing. You're absolutely right about that. Although, I wrote about this in my story, there was this amazing case in New York. A New York police detective. He somehow got, of course, he had the right to access the police department database. He went through the database, trolled these women that he found attractive who were in the database, and then he started doing Google searches to try to figure out what it would be like I don't think I should say what he wanted to do to these women. It was unbelievably awful.
Yeah.
And he just built up these files on his computer, partly built by doing Google searches about all the terrible things he wanted to do to these women. He was arrested. He was convicted of conspiracy to commit kidnapping. He served 21 months in prison. And then a judge looked at the whole case and threw it out. Why? Because he never harmed a soul. All he did was fantasize about it.
And his wife brought forward the searches.
That's right. That's right. It was his wife who brought, that's right. And you can imagine why. She was terrified.
Right.
But it was appealed to a federal court. Federal court threw the case out. They said, this guy hasn't done a thing except fantasize. He did get a misdemeanor conviction for misusing the police database. But for committing any other crime? No. You need a lot more than a Google search to do it. Now, it's important to note, this is kind of different from what you see in social media. Because everybody knows that people who post things on Twitter that seem threatening or menacing can be kicked off of Twitter or kicked off of Facebook, which shows that they are monitoring. Those guys are monitoring people
in real time.
In real time or near real time. Mm. And as we know very well, if you use these, they don't catch everything. Sometimes really awful things do end up getting through. But if they are reported, they will quickly do something about, freezing the account, canceling the account, something like that. But there's a fundamental difference. When you write a message in Google, you're not talking to a human being. You're asking a computer a question. Mm-hmm. When you post stuff on Facebook or Twitter, you're talking to people. Mm-hmm. And you are creating a real risk that you're doing something. You might be wanting to do something bad.
And what about, the privacy search engines like DuckDuckGo or something like that?
Yeah, if you were using a service like a DuckDuckGo, they wouldn't. They're supposedly, they don't keep records of what you're doing at all. So you've got that. There are other things you could do. For example, you could use a VPN, a virtual private network. That fakes the IP address that you're using when you enter one of these services. So the IP address that they see is not the IP address of your actual computer. So there are definitely ways you can cover your tracks. But again, just in and of itself, seeing that somebody posted a weird-looking search message on Google just isn't much evidence of anything. And so there's no way they're going to treat something like that automatically as something criminal.
What about these keyword searches?
You're talking about, that's a somewhat different matter and a really weird one. There have been cases in which, in fact, there's a case right now pending, I forget which court it's in, where somebody was, it's down in, is it Georgia, where a house got burned
down.
Colorado. House gets burned down, 5 people killed, absolutely horrible. Right. The police are trying to figure out who possibly had done this. And they were doing keyword searches to try to find out everybody who had searched for any information relating to the crime during a particular window of time. And Google has gone along with this, but there are courts that are now saying this is like a fishing expedition and we shouldn't allow it. What they did was they eventually found one of the 3 suspects that they currently got in prison or in jail for doing this. One of the 3 suspects, on the day of, or I think the day before the house burned, did a Google search for information about that address. And that was the only person they found who matched any of the other information that they had. And it turned out, sure enough, one of the suspects had searched for information about the house that got burned on that day. But the defense attorneys are saying that's just a fishing expedition. And a lot of people are arguing the keyword searches should not be allowed. The courts are eventually going to decide whether or not they can possibly do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to understand what we're talking about here. The police go to these guys and they say, we want you to tell us everybody who searched for the words X. I mean, everybody in all of, say, the United States, or mm-hmm. everybody in the state of Georgia, maybe, or everybody in the city of Boston who searched for this word on this date. That's a pretty broad brush.
Right. What about those privacy policies that no one ever reads and just checks I accept? I mean, do they outline what can and can't be done with your searches, with your keywords? I mean, or is this new territory here?
No, this isn't really new territory, because police have been getting this kind of information for a long time.
So we agree to...
Basically agreeing to do this. And you can exercise some measure of control. Like I said, if you have your own Google account, you can go in and tell it, delete all my search history. They don't actually delete the searches. They just disconnect your name from it so that they can't go back and find that it was you who did these searches. You can exercise some control over that. And as I've already given you other ways that you could do a Google search and cover your tracks. So there are ways to do it. But yeah, if you're doing any of these things on any of these online services, you're leaving behind all kinds of trails. And I would think by now every person in America knows that. So
do you see a future where, you know, search engine providers would be obligated to notify police of anything?
No way. I mean, that's the central problem here, because I think, as we've already said, there's just no practical way you can prove that someone has criminal intent just because they did a Google search for something awful. I've done that. You've done that.
Did you ever read Orwell? Come on.
Nah. Oh, look, there's a lot of stuff to be worried about here, believe me. I just don't think this is one of them.
All right. Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray, thanks so much as always for being with us.
It's been fun. Okay.
The restaurant May May, run by chef and co-founded by Irene Lee, was known for its blend of cultural dishes and contemporary tastes, like the Double Awesome. That's a breakfast sandwich on a freshly made scallion pancake. But when Lee closed her restaurant's doors in March of 2020, the future was definitely not clear. By June of that year, she didn't know what her business would evolve into, but she was fairly sure it would not be a restaurant. Well, fast forward 2.5 years, and May May's new dumpling factory has officially opened. On Saturday, it set a record for the biggest single day of sales in May May's 10-year existence. We caught up with Irene Lee earlier today, and I started by asking her about that milestone.
So we had been kind of softly opening for about a week, but Saturday was the big day. And so we had so many people come through for takeout, to eat in, to get dumplings to take home. And yeah, it's the biggest single day of sales our business has ever had, which feels very auspicious.
Wow. Right. Are you surprised?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that coming out of COVID, having a good day of any kind as a business is sort of a surprise. But at the same time, you know, all the folks who came in, I was excited to see them and glad that they made it. And many of them are our supporters for the last decade, not to mention my own mom, who brought about 20 people with her. she's been behind us for much longer than that. So I think, you know, it is a delightful surprise to see that people want to come in and are ready to eat dumplings and Double Awesomes in our space. And at the same time, you know, we have been kind of banking on our community continuing to show up for us.
Why did you decide on dumplings?
Dumplings make people happy, I think. And every culture has a dumpling, you know, some kind of delicious thing wrapped in a delicious thing. And so at May May, we like to say dumplings make the world go round. And our experience is that as soon as people hear dumplings, like, they don't need to hear that much more. They're sold.
They want them. Right.
Yes. And we can kind of put anything in a dumpling and get people excited about it. So for us, it's really a vehicle.
Do you have a favorite dumpling, or is that sort of like asking a parent to identify a favorite child?
I definitely have a favorite dumpling, and I have no children, so I don't have to make that comparison. But My favorite of our dumplings is probably the cheddar scallion potato, which I like to say is our love letter to the pierogi and the knish, both of which we grew up eating in our Asian American household. And, you know, I think for me, it's really kind of an expression of growing up in New England, growing up in Boston, and also being Chinese. And so putting anything in a dumpling, and cheese definitely plays a big role in our cuisine at Maymay, very non-traditionally Chinese. So I think that dumpling I will just never get sick of. And I think it captures a lot of the spirit of what Maymay is.
And you know, at the factory, people can actually watch the dumplings being made, right?
Yeah, isn't that cool?
It's very cool, especially for someone like me who can't quite get the dumpling technique down. But tell me first why you decided that was something you wanted to include.
Well, Deb, you'll have to come in for a class.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we think all dumplings are beautiful, and it's what's on the inside that counts. So a lot of life lessons in dumpling making. But we had a sort of moment in planning out the future of the business where we had to ask ourselves if we wanted to go to a co-packer, another company that would use our recipes and make our dumplings, or if we wanted to open our own space and really own the production chain from start to finish. And at Maymay, we've always been really committed to trying to tell the full story of food, trying to provide transparency that is meaningful to guests. And so what better way to do that than to have literally a transparent window that shows all of the food being made? And I also just love seeing machinery. I love seeing things in process. And so I got kind of excited thinking like, wow, this might be one of the only dumpling factories that people can actually come to and see the food getting made.
So while I have you on the line, I may get yelled at for asking this, but I'm going to ask you for some personal help with my dumpling technique. I can never get them to seal, right? The ingredients just explode and I can't get the dough to seal so it stays inside. What's a trick?
Okay. Are you making your dough from scratch? Or are you using grocery store wrappers?
Sometimes grocery store wrappers, I guess mostly.
Okay. Excellent. No shame in that. That's what we did my whole childhood. So there is, I think, a challenge, a tension between putting too much water on the wrapper and putting too little on the wrapper. So we always say you want it to be kind of damp and like tacky, but not sort of dripping wet. And one of the things that I always like to tell people is if you're pan frying your dumplings, it really doesn't matter if they explode. So a pan fry will kind of retain at least some of the shape. And then if your dumplings pop open in the pan, it kind of creates this delicious sauce for the outside of the dumpling. So, you know, I try to look on the bright side of all possible outcomes.
Okay. It's all about the water. I got it. It's been, really a wild couple of years for you. You closed your restaurant in March of 2020, that little global pandemic thing going on.
Yes.
You said publicly just a couple of months later that the business would continue, but probably not as a restaurant. What were you thinking at that time when you were realizing that, you're going to have to make some changes?
Yeah, I'll be really honest. I was in a place personally where I felt like I just built up this company. We just paid off most of our debt. I don't want to go back to the beginning and do it again. If I'm going to keep pouring myself into this project, at least let it be something new. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of sort of evolving the business, pivoting, as some would like to say, that was just on a lot of levels, it was personal. And then we also saw that there was a compelling business case for it. And so those two things really aligned for us.
Right. And a few months into the pandemic, some workers had to be laid off, and you've described that experience as a quote, seven-layer dip of despair. It sounds awful, but now you're on the other side, right? So has your thinking about that changed at all? Would you do anything differently?
That's a great question. I think for me, the challenge of laying folks off several months into the pandemic, after we had worked really hard to keep them employed, to try and kind of find ways to get hours for them, the lesson for me was the more cared for your employees feel, the worse they're going to feel when you can't care for them anymore. And so there is kind of an irony there. But I think for me, I followed the kind of by the book HR policies that any kind of corporate person would dictate. And I don't normally do that. And so in a lot of ways, I felt that the stakes were so high, I didn't want to get anything wrong. But in doing so, I didn't really follow my instinct around what was best for our team. And so I think for me, trusting my gut is one of the things that I am going to take away from this. And continuing to be transparent with workers about how the company is faring, what the future of their jobs are, something I think we're really dialing in right now. Especially with so much change in the business, we have spent a lot of resources on change management, on communicating with every single person, you know, what to expect and what the unexpected might be. So I think those are ways that our business has really grown.
Hmm. Are there any other pandemic lessons that you would take with you?
I think we all learned that beautiful food experiences don't have to happen in a restaurant. And I think about my friend Seiji from Cafe Sushi, who is not going to reopen his dining room, but still serves the most beautiful sushi for takeout that you can get in the city. I think about a lot of our colleagues and peers who really got their pop-up going. They transitioned to a product like we did. And I think that the restaurant industry is in this interesting place where we're all trying to figure out how to make it work. And if it looks less like traditional restaurant dining, I think that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, it seems to be. It seems to be a trend. You know, I read shortly before the pandemic, I believe you started opening up your books, if you will, right, and actually showing some of the financial details of running a restaurant. And I read, and I believe this was early 2020, that because I remember it, your profit for the year was like $20,000. I gulped for you. $20,000. That's it for the year. Do you think that this transparency is effective? And what does this say about sort of the changing restaurant world? And will you continue to provide that information?
Yeah, so we had been sharing our profit and loss statements with our team for about 2 years at the point where in very early 2020, we decided to have a public P&L review event. And so we invited about 150 folks. People signed on this technology called Zoom that no one had ever used before. and we walked through our entire profit and loss statement for 2019. And you are correct that we showed about 2.2% profit, which was about $20,000. And I think that we absolutely plan to continue this kind of transparency. And what's really exciting is we are seeing other folks in the industry following that principle, because the economy is such that we as the industry can no longer absorb all of the increased costs. And so you've seen, you know, kind of leading chefs sharing that their fryer oil cost X in 2020, and now it costs 3X. And that is why, you know, the price of chicken wings is going up. So I think that we are having this moment where we really need guests to understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. And we can do that in a kind of one-off way where we shout about different tidbits, or we can be really intentional about making sure guests understand more holistically what it means to dine in a restaurant. And that has always really been Maymay's approach.
Hmm. Now, last year, you know, after going through a lot of turmoil, you won a James Beard Award for leadership. Do you remember getting the award? And what did that mean to you after all of this?
I was really speechless when I got the phone call. And you know, I had been very, very honored to be nominated for a chef award, which is a totally different category, several years in a row. But to me, leadership felt like, in a lot of ways, like the first and the last thing that I was eligible for. I had been through so much self-doubt during the pandemic. I knew that I wanted to make my team proud. And that is why we took on emergency feeding, why we created Project Restore Us. And I think in a way, that's what leadership is all about, is creating an environment creating a business that people can be really proud to engage with. And so it was a huge honor. And we're super grateful for the platform that that's continued to provide to us as we sort of try to push the industry forward.
And you're now working on a digital tool to help restaurants. You won't be involved so much in the day-to-day operations of the dumpling factory, but you'll be working on this. Well, can you explain that a little bit? And why did you decide to make the change?
PrepShift is our new kind of tech-enabled consulting company. I run that with Dylan Gully and Carla Cornejo. Carla was part of the Maymay team during COVID. And we really are invested in having a vibrant, diverse, equitable restaurant industry in the future, so that when I'm old, I have cool stuff to eat. So we are working to take some of the best practices that we know in the industry, some that we developed at Maymay, and to leverage those for businesses that might not traditionally be able to afford consulting. We're working through the state of Massachusetts, the Workforce Training Fund, and we also are trying really hard to build more productive and healthy relationships between operators and their team. And of course, open book management and kind of intentional transparency is part of that as well. Mm-hmm. So I really feel that it's about paying forward the lessons that I've learned and wanting to make sure that, you know, when I'm old, it's not all just chains and the kind of top 50 restaurants. It's been so cool to see Boston's restaurant community become more diverse. And I really want us to continue on that trajectory.
Right. And so you mentioned those classes, those dumpling classes. I think I definitely have to take one. If I do, you're going to show me the water technique.
Of course,
to seal them. But can you tell me a little bit about what these classes are?
The dumpling classes are kind of one of my favorite things that we do. We started these prior to the pandemic. We took them virtual for the duration of the pandemic. And now that we're back in our space, we can invite people in again. The classes are kind of inspired by some of our favorite childhood memories. Growing up in Boston for Lunar New Year, our parents would invite all of the friends and neighbors over. We'd all sit around the kitchen table with a big bowl of dumpling filling in the middle, and we would all make dumplings, eat dumplings, and take frozen dumplings home with us. So we think those are skills that anyone can learn. And there's just something so special about sitting around that table and creating something with people you love. So we want to spread the kind of dumpling cheer and the dumpling love with our community. And the classes are the number one way that we can do that.
That's Irene Lee, chef and co-founder of Maymay. She'll be appearing as part of the WBUR City Space Curated Cuisine Series on Monday, February 6th. You can find more information about that on our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.